The following views and opinions are not necessarily those of Valley FM, any of its staff, management, ownership, or any affiliates.
On my own radar, I start picking up items going 3,000-4,000 miles an hour in this area.
But I do remember speeds in excess of 4,000 to 5,000 miles an hour.
And he said it was traveling 10,000 miles plus.
And they were going somewhere in the neighborhood of 11 to 14,000 miles an hour.
They covered the distance from Columbus to Detroit in something like equivalent of about 20,000 miles an hour.
And I heard a couple women there in the Air Force talking about aircraft Mach 10 plus, you're at Mach 10 plus, flying in and out of the atmosphere at Mach 10 plus.
This is Conspiracy with your host, Earl Benezet, on Alley FM. Earl Benezet, former Kentucky MUFON chapter director, explore the possibilities of life out there and other conspiracy theories. Conspiracy with Earl Benezet starts now on Alley FM, the best of the best.
Good evening, folks, and welcome to another edition of Conspiracy with your host, Earl Benezet, and our most famous guest, Stanton Friedman. Stanton, it's a pleasure to have you here, and I can't wait to hear everything you can tell us.
Gee, should I recite the alphabet?
You could say anything you want. People will believe it.
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny that you say that, because when I first started speaking, scared me, because people would indeed believe what I said. I was a Westinghouse nuclear physicist in a town in the West Pittsburgh area where Westinghouse was, you know, was very special. And it scared me because I remember from World War II that Hitler and Mussolini were great speakers.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt an obligation. If I'm going to talk, I better be talking the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And I've tried to stick to that through 700 lectures in 50 states, 9 provinces, and 16 other countries, and 200 radio and television shows. I hope I've succeeded, but it is a problem, because people want to set aside their thinking capabilities and just absorb, you know, he must know what he's talking about, he's a nuclear physicist, stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to be careful, and I have a very large gray basket. That is, a lot of questions, I have to say, I don't have enough data to give you an answer. It's in my gray bag. It's not black, not white, it's maybe. I don't know. There's nothing wrong with saying you don't have enough data.
Well, that's what people appreciate, is the fact that you are accurate. When you're going to say something, you can back it up.
Well, I try to do that. I mean, look, I worked as a nuclear physicist for 14 years and then did consulting work after that. When I gave a paper at a technical meeting, it had to be approved by my boss and his boss. I mean, the company's mm-hmm. name. I worked for big companies, GE, GM, Westinghouse, Aerojet
mm-hmm.
General, et cetera. The company's name was on that, you know, so you've got to be careful.
You
stick to the facts. And it's one of the things that I was just watching, as a matter of fact, just by coincidence, checking my email, and somebody sent along a 9-minute clip of an astronomer from the Hayden Planetarium in New York poo-pooing UFOs, all aspects. Starting out, you know, the real problem is, he says, that people are arguing from ignorance. Well, I couldn't identify what it was, so he says, they say, so it must have been an alien spacecraft. Well, that's hogwash. He was the guy who was arguing. No indication
exactly.
at all that he'd read any of the large-scale scientific studies that are out there. And I talk about 5 in my lectures.
Mm-hmm.
He attacked the notion of eyewitness testimony, poorest form of evidence there is, even though it's the highest in the legal system. But he totally neglects the fact that the reason most UFO sightings can be identified as something relatively conventional, we change the U in UFO to I identifying,
mm-hmm.
is that witness testimony is pretty darn good. Interpretation is another matter. But we know it was Venus because the witness said it was at this angle above the horizon. He was looking in that direction, and the time was about 3:30 in the morning. You go check, and son of a gun, that was Venus. Now, he didn't know it was Venus. He probably had never paid any attention to it. But it was a perfect example. He has said equally stupid things, and I don't often use that word, but he deserves it.
I love it.
on the Peter Jennings mockumentary, for example, he came up with this great idea. After all, there's nothing to UFOs, because our fastest craft, the Voyager spacecraft, would take 70,000 years to get to the nearest star, and scientists like to be around when your experimental data comes home, you know. He doesn't bother to say, oh, there's no propulsion system on the thing. It's coasting.
Yeah.
You know, minor detail. Yeah. 70,000 years? Who cares?
What about the one that we tested in 1968? Millions of electron volts, and all of a sudden it went deep black. Or it went away. I probably thought it went deep black. Somebody.
I'm not sure what, you mean as a nuclear rocket?
Yeah, yeah, it's something.
Well, okay, I worked on fission nuclear rockets, and mm-hmm. I also worked on fusion nuclear rockets.
Uh-huh.
Indeed, in the 60s, we tested, well, a half dozen of them, nuclear rocket engines out in the desert. And out near your area, 51, west of Vegas, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And our biggest one, which was built by Los Alamos, was 4,400 megawatts. That's twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam.
Yep. Wow.
And it ran for the required length of time. That was fission. Now, it's not going to do a good job of getting you to the stars because, well, it doesn't compare with a Saturn V for capability. It's great for an upper stage, not mm-hmm. for a launch. But much more exciting, actually, is fusion. I worked on that in 1961, 62. Now, people should understand that fusion, whether you know it or not, is the most important source of energy in all our lives. That's what's going on in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a mass of burning gas. No Arabs up there. It's a fusion factory. And if you use the right stuff in the right way, and we at Aerojet General Nuclionics did a $9 million study from the Air Force to look into this, you can kick particles out the back end of a rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a double
wow.
chemical rocket. Now, the funny thing is, Dr. Tyson, the scientist I was talking about, is an astronomer. He knows all the stars work by fusion.
Mm-hmm.
But, of
mm-hmm.
course, since the work isn't done in academia, it must not exist.
And,
you know, a good example for people who wonder about, you know, let's be talking about nuclear fusion. Well, we Earthlings, in all our smarts, in 1938, finally figured out that it was probably fusion that produced the energy in the sun. And being the kind of critters we are, in 1952, we put that knowledge to work. We exploded the first H-bomb. On an island in the Pacific, the fireball was only, this was at the end of October, I guess, 1952, big year for UFOs, the fireball was only 3 miles in diameter.
Only.
Can you imagine what the aliens said about that? What are these idiots doing now?
Not only that, but, you know, if it's true that we know that there's 11 dimensions at least, maybe 0.5 microns across, that maybe it affected some other dimensions, and maybe that's why they were so pissed.
Well, I don't worry about other dimensions.
You can't.
Much closer to the narrow. I mean, the string theorists who worry about 11 the last time I heard, they don't have any experimental data to fall back on.
True.
Beautiful theory.
True.
Loads of equations.
Talk about another theory. What about gravity wave theory? I love to talk about that.
Well, let's start from the beginning. Yes, gravity exists. You and I aren't floating around because the mass of the Earth pulls us down, and we're being small and the Earth being large, it pulls us toward them rather than the Earth toward us.
Mm-hmm.
But we have still not measured gravity waves, and we still don't know if they do exist, that we can use them for propulsion. I'm not saying fusion is the ultimate, not by any means. I mean, Friedman's law, I make them up, thing. Technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You have to change how you do things. A laser isn't just a better light bulb, in other words. It's entirely different physics. The nuclear weapons aren't just, or nuclear rockets aren't just better chemical rockets. Entirely different physics. So, there's a lot going on that we don't know about. And I'm
just
sure
let you know, we're going to take a break in about 60 seconds or less.
Okay. Just want to stress, I'm not saying this is the ultimate. I'm saying we already know how to get to nearby stars. I'm only interested in the local neighborhood. I am not interested in going to other galaxies or across our own galaxy 100,000 light years across. And I want a loaf of bread down at the grocery store. I'm not looking to go to that bakery in Sydney, Australia to get my loaf of bread. I don't have the time.
Unless you could jump in a jump room and get there immediately.
Well, yeah, I don't know how to do those things. I'm not saying there isn't a way, but I'm saying before we go to that which we know nothing about, let's stick with what we do know something about and look at that. It looks feasible. And let me throw in one fact to ponder about.
You know what? Can you hold that, Stanton? Because I've got to take a break right now. We'll be back with Conspiracy with our special guest, Stanton Friedman.
From the pristine air that surrounds Cave Run Lake to the ease of access of Interstate 64 to the friendly folks that have a small town feel with a big city appeal, Moorhead, Kentucky is the vacation destination that makes sense. Cave Run Lake is one of the most popular destinations for vacationers in America. Its sprawling 872 acres of clean blue water and land is a hub for boating, fishing, swimming, camping, and all sorts of outdoor activities. Lodging is affordable, and with Cave Run Cabin Rentals, you'll enjoy a beautiful mountainous view and the company of great friends, or that special someone. Great activities, fantastic dining, beautiful views. In Moorhead, Kentucky, we've got it all. For information about your vacation destination, call 606-784-5874. That's 606-784-5874. And ask for Rodney Hitch. In Moorhead, Kentucky, the only thing missing is you. This message has been brought to you by the Round County Tourism and Moorhead Economic Development Council, who really miss you. If you're starting up a small business or already own one and you're looking to cater and market to a worldwide audience, AlleyFM.com could be your solution. Recently, Forbes magazine made the statement that internet broadcasting is a trend of the future. One of the most notable statements in this article was that most of the people that do business with the internet or on the internet had expendable incomes and greater earnings than $75,000 per year and more. To find out just exactly how small of an investment that you would have to make in AlleyFM.com to see substantial dividends and gains, call us toll free at 1-888-722-3134. That's 1-888-722-3134. You can also email us, AlleyFMRadio@gmail.com. That's AlleyFMRadio@gmail.com. Let us put two decades plus of marketing experience to work for you.
Welcome back to Conspiracy with your host, Earl Benazet, and my special guest, Stanton Friedman. And I have a question, Stanton, about this gravity wave theory. What is your opinion on that, if you could accelerate? Because I know Einstein's theory said that, you know, if you, as you approach the speed of light, mass becomes so humongous, then you need all the power in the universe to push yourself past it. Do you agree with that, or how's your opinion?
No, I don't. Engineers are smart. They figure out solutions to problems rather than all the ways you can't do anything. I'm reminded of the astronomer who in 1941 calculated the required mass of a rocket able to get a man to the moon and back. Pages of equations, published this paper incidentally. Bottom line, it would have to weigh a million tons. Ha, ha, ha. We did it with something. We got three guys to the moon and back. It only weighed 3,000. He was off by a factor of 300 million. that's pretty far off. Why? Because he made all the wrong, stupid assumptions.
Interesting.
He said, for example, a single-stage rocket limited to 1G acceleration, where the rocket has to provide all the energy. That's just three quickies. The acceleration goes up to 5Gs. That greatly reduces the mass required. The rocket doesn't provide all the energy. We launch to the east near the equator. That's at 3,000 miles an hour. We let the moon's gravity pull us in. There's another freebie. When we come back, we don't fire a retro rocket as we assumed we must. Instead, we use the Earth's atmosphere. Remember Apollo 13. You better get the angle right or you're in bad trouble.
Yep.
In other words, if you make stupid assumptions, you come up with wrong solutions. Okay. Does the mass increase as you approach the speed of light? Yes. And of course it doesn't. We have to take that into account when we build accelerators. However, when you're operating, say, a fusion rocket, you're using, say, deuterium and helium-3. These are two low-mass isotopes.
Mm-hmm.
When they react, when they fuse, they produce charged particles, primarily, having 10 million times energy, as much energy per particle, as they can get in a chemical rocket. In other words, you're not accelerating the particles. The fusion process produces them. What you're doing is directing them out the back end. That's the nice thing about them being charged particles as opposed to those darn neutrons, which go out in all directions. So, in the first place, that's wrong. In the second place, there are many situations where we do cosmic freeloading. I just mentioned a couple. Earth's rotation gives us a 3,000 miles an hour. We have a launch window to the moon. Now, why should that be? Because if we pick the time right, the moon will come along and pull us in the rest of the way.
Mm-hmm.
All our deep space probes, when we go to past Jupiter, past Saturn.
Mm-hmm. The slingshot effect, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, with Cassini spacecraft, which is near Saturn, we sent it inward past Venus to get a free kick, past the Earth to get another free kick, past Jupiter to get another free kick.
Mm.
So we didn't supply all that energy. It came from the universe. Mother Nature is very kind. We sometimes abuse her. That's another story. So are there other possible means, wormholes, light holes, all this kind of stuff? Sure, these are nice, theoretically interesting constructs. But in academia is not where you expect the action to be. It's one of the problems I have. I speak at colleges, and these guys rarely, if ever, know anything at all about what's going on out in the real world. Well, for example, when I was interviewed for that Peter Jennings mockumentary, we finished the interview. It went well. It was at a museum in Roswell. It lasted for about an hour. He asked sensible questions. They're wrapping up. And he said, Stan, don't you think if these things are real, that half the academic scientists would be doing their research on flying saucers? I said, absolutely not. Those who can do, those who can't teach. You want a stealth fighter? You go to Lockheed. You spend $10 billion in 10 years, and you wind up with a bunch of stealth fighters.
Hmm.
You know, you want progress technologically. You don't go to academia. To give you an example of this, when I was working on nuclear airplanes, way back in 1958, at General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, just outside Cincinnati, Evendale, Ohio. We employed 3,500 people, 1,100 of whom were engineers and scientists. The total amount we spent in 1958 was $100 million.
In 58, wow.
In 58, that was a lot of money. I mean, to some people, it's a lot of money now, like me.
Yeah, I agree.
In other words, it wasn't for professors and 12 grad students.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it was the data was classified. It was not a black budget program. In other words, the sign on the door said General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department. But the data was classified. There's another thing academics, most of them, have trouble with. They're in the publisher perish business. I had a guy who told me Roswell couldn't have happened. If it had, there'd have been a paper in the Physical Review analyzing those materials within months.
Yeah, and who's going to give them the materials?
Well, I think you've got to be crazy. The first nuclear chain reaction was in 1942. Was it published? Of course not. It was classified. And, you know, can governments keep secrets? Seth Shostak, with whom I have tangled on more than one occasion, he used as an example, look, any government that can get in the messes that did with FEMA, with Katrina, obviously can't keep secrets.
Oh, really?
Well, I mentioned the stealth program, but I would also mention that the Corona spy satellite, 1960, there were 12 failures in secret. The 13th one worked. It got more data about Soviet military installations than all the U-2 flights that had preceded it.
Wow.
Was it announced? Of course not. The first public discussion of the Corona spy satellite was in 1995, 35 years later. And there were several of them that were launched, incidentally. The British, during World War II, the German code had been broken. There were 12,000 people at Bletchley Park in England, whose job was to intercept German military communication, decode them, translate them, and very carefully distribute them to people with the need to know. We didn't want the Germans to know we'd broken the code, because then they'd have changed it, and we'd have been in terrible trouble.
We'd be back at square one.
Now, you'd think that at the end of the war, we would have said, look what we did, wasn't it great? If it's 25 years before we admitted that, simple little.
And we broke the Japanese code, too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was the magic program.
And didn't we break it before Pearl Harbor?
There is. We had broken some of it before Pearl Harbor. The question isn't whether somebody somewhere might have picked up the signal, but whether that signal had been translated and been available. Remember the report, the attack came on a Sunday morning. And, you know, if you went through the translation on Monday, it's a little bit too late, isn't it?
Well, the conspiracy theorists will say, oh, well, you know, Roosevelt was dying to have us in war, and they knew it, and they let it happen.
Well, yeah, you know, there's a difference between a conspiracy, a theoretical construct, maybe. Have there been conspiracies? Yeah, I'm sure there have been. But I don't consider working under security part of a conspiracy.
It's just natural.
In other words,
yeah.
I had a clearance for 14 years. There were certain instructions that went with the program, certain duties and responsibilities and agreements that you made. You weren't conspiring with anybody. You were following the rules. Good, bad, or indifferent, that isn't the point.
Right.
That's not a conspiracy. And people say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. I am not. I prove, and I don't use that word too often, but I prove that the United States government is withholding information about UFOs. Now, how do I do that? Well, I show them some of the National Security Agency documents about UFOs. After many years, they released a bunch of these things, 156 documents, I guess 220-some pages. UFO documents, that's what they're called. The only trouble is they use whiteout extensively, and you can read one or two lines per page. The CIA, there's some top secret documents they still won't release, but I have several that they released that, would you believe, you can read eight words on a page, everything else is blacked out, not whited out. And I say, didn't like blacked out documents being shown on television. Made them look silly. But as another example, we have the testimony in a written memo by General Carol Bolander. The memo was dated like October 1969, and it resulted in the closure of Project Blue Book a couple months later. And it was his job. He had nothing previous to do with Project Blue Book. He'd been working on the Lunar Excursion Module program 12 hours a day. He was an engineer. We landed on the moon. Hey, it worked. Then his assignment was, what should we do about Blue Book? Because the University of Colorado study, the Condon Report, recommended it be closed. Because it wasn't contributing anything, frankly, to either intelligence or technology. They're right about that. Anyway, Bolander went through all kinds of stuff. And he put out a little memo that we didn't get until many years later. A guy named Bob Todd in Pennsylvania managed to get this with one of his zillion Freedom of Information Act requests. Anyway, buried in the memo is the statement that, moreover, reports of UFOs which could affect national security made in accordance with Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system. That's a very strong statement. Two paragraphs later, he reiterates it. He says, if Project Blue Book is closed, then the public will not have a place, a government place to report sightings to. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the regulations established for that purpose.
Earl Benezet, Michael Higdon, and Chris Dedman, the best of the best in talk, is right here on Alley FM.
And so the public, the American public, the New York Times has never told us that, oh, Blue Book didn't get the good stuff. You know, who cares about what's flying outside my house? UFO sightings occur all the time. But if a UFO goes down the runway at a Strategic Air Command base where nuclear weapons are stored, that's a national security problem.
Yep.
And as a further indication of that, John Greenwald, with his excellent site,
The Black Vault,
where he's got thousands of documents, he has collected instructions to pilots of our top aircraft, our fighter planes and stuff, what they should do if they see an unidentified surface ship, unidentified submarine, unidentified aircraft.
Let me guess. Film it and get away.
No, the last category was unidentified flying object, and it takes prompt action to report it, and it gives numbers. It's a high priority item, et cetera, et cetera. But the Air Force will tell you, oh, we don't do anything about UFOs anymore. They're lying. There's a piece on my website at www.stantonfriedman.com, and you got to spell Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, otherwise. There's an article called Government UFO Lies. It's a fairly long article because there have been loads of government UFO lies. You know, so what I'm saying here is if you want to talk about cover-up, that's fine. Show the evidence. It's there. There's no way to fight with that. I mean, ask the NSA, how could it be that 98% of this document is about, of all these documents, is about sources and methods information, and only 2 or 3% are about UFOs when it's listed as NSA UFO documents. Anybody who believes that probably believes in the Tooth Fairy, for goodness sake, or the Easter Bunny, or Santa Claus, or what, these other myths of space age. That sounds a little funny, but those. What I'm trying to say here is, if you're going to get into ufology, have facts in hand before putting mouth in ear, is the way I feel. And look, I've written 4 books. I'm working on number 5 now.
Do you know what's the name of it? What's it going to be called? Do you know yet?
It's been changed. The publisher changed it. I originally wanted it to be It's Impossible, Isn't It? But the publisher changed it to Science Was Wrong.
Oh, yeah.
I should wear a bulletproof vest when I go.
Uh-oh.
But the basic concept is this. When you start looking, you find that progress in many different areas, medicine, space, aviation, has been greatly hindered by very smart people saying very stupid things and getting in the way. You know, the British Astronomer Royal, less than 2 years before Sputnik, said space travel is utter filth. Nobody's going to spend the money to do that. And besides, it'd be much more useful if we built better instruments for astronomy. Ironically,
we're doing both.
Astronomy, astronomy has benefited enormously from the space age with things like the Hubble Space Telescope, the Kepler Space Telescope, the Chandra one. There's a whole bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them that I particularly am pleased about is Hipparco. It's an European satellite, made a few million measurements of the distances to nearby stars. That's very important in pinning down. Astronomers didn't really care how far away things are. Two angles and you can look at anything through a telescope. But when you start looking at the Betty and Barney Hill case, for example, we have the star map. that Betty described, that Marjorie Fish researched.
Mm-hmm. Is that Beta Reticuli 1 and 2? Is that what we think?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. This is discussed in detail in the book Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. My co-author is Kathleen Martin, who's Betty's niece, had all the tapes of the hypnosis sessions, all the correspondence, cool. All the rest of that. And the key thing is that identification depended on having accurate distance data. Marjorie Fish did the best she could back in the late 60s, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have much better data, and Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, my favorite pair of stars, mm-hmm. just happen to be unique. They're the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire local neighborhood. And this is where I say I don't care about other galaxies. They're, now we know, it's 39.3 light years away from us. That's just down the street.
Yeah, just a drop in the bucket.
Well, it is compared to 100,000 light years across the galaxy, or mm-hmm. 2 million light years to Andromeda. Who cares about that?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the interesting thing about those two stars, not only are they close, and both sunlight, as are all the other stars in the past.
Now, we've got 28 seconds left, by the way, for the next break.
Okay, they're a billion years older than the sun, and they're only an eighth of a light year apart. Think about what that means.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. We've got about 20 seconds to go.
Oh, well, this stuff is discussed in detail in the book Captured, and
mm-hmm.
I've just written another article defending against the attacks of the nasty noise.
Oh, and I got to cut it. And we'll be right back with Conspiracy with Stanton Freeman. I can't wait to hear more, Stanton.
Benazet, Michael Higdon, and Chris Dedman, the best of the best in talk is right here on Alley FM.
Just moved in my new house today. Moving was hard, but I got squared away. Bell started ringing and chains rattled loud. I knew I'd moved in a haunted house. Still I made up in my mind to stay. When I seen something to give me the creep. Had one big eye and a two big feet. I stood right still and I did the freak. He did the stroll right up to me. Made a noise with his feet to sound like a drum. Say you'll be here when the morning comes. Yes, I'll be here when the morning comes. I'll be right here and I ain't gonna run. I bought this house, now you know I'm boss. Ain't no hang gonna run me off. In my kitchen, my stove was a blazing hot. The coffee was a boiling in the pot. Melted in my hand. I had a hunk of meat in my hand. From outer space that sat a man on a hot stove with a pots and pans. Say that's hot, I began to shout. He drank a hot coffee right from the spout. He ate the raw meat right from my hand. Drank a hot grease from the frying pan. He said to me, now you better run. Don't be here when the morning comes. See, yes, I'll be here when the morning.
Welcome back to Conspiracy with Earl Benezet, your host, and my interesting guest, Stanton Friedman. Continue where you were, Stanton. That was really interesting.
Well, just the uniqueness of Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticula. It's a constellation of reticula. We can't see them from where we are. You've got to go much closer to the equator.
Mm-hmm.
They're only 39.3 light years away. That's just down the street. There's both sunlight, and that's only sunlike. That's only true of 5% of the stars in our local neighborhood. So you have 1,000 stars within roughly 55 light years. Only about 50 are similar to the sun and might be expected to have planets and light.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition, they're a cool billion years older than the sun. That has two obvious ramifications. One is, when you're only an eighth of a light year apart, that's 34 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. We're out in the galactic boondocks. These two stars are next door neighbors.
Mm.
But, and from a planet around one, you can directly observe planets around the other. No guessing game. The other thing is, being a billion years older than us, it seems very likely to me that you're going to develop a little more technology than we already have. Just look back 105 years, 106 years.
Exactly.
The first flight was in 1903. You know, we've come a long way. We didn't even invent the neutron until 1932. Fusion we figured out in 38, fission in 39. Look at your computer today. If you had that 40 years ago, it would have been worth how much? The internet, all kinds of things. So give somebody a little head start on us, you know, 500, 5,000, 5 million years, they're going to develop technology, which by Arthur C. Clarke's definition is magic,
mm-hmm.
you know, the technology of the future. So incidentally, back then, we hadn't yet observed any planets around other stars. And our whole notion of what the neighborhood is like drastically changed. Remember when we were told Mars was a dry, dead, desert-like planet?
Yep.
Never had water, nothing there, don't worry about it. Now we know that it had a lot of water all over the place.
It still does. I don't know about a lot, but it still has water.
Well, we also just found that there is water on the moon. Now,
mm-hmm.
it's included in the dirt, so to speak. And what is it, October, I think it's the 9th, the 6th or the 9th, we're going to drop a satellite there.
Yeah, and I heard we changed the positioning of where it's going to go, and I'm thankful for that.
Yeah.
I'll tell you about that later, or you probably know about that.
Well, the interesting thing is that now we think we have observed three different satellites and evidence for water on the moon. No, it's not sitting out in the lake, but it's encapsulated in the ground. So we thought Venus was a nice tropical paradise 60 years ago. Well, if you like 600 degree temperatures, not enough to melt lead, and the atmosphere being made out of sulfuric acid vapor, well, I guess you could say it's a tropical paradise.
I went over to Venus for 2 nanoseconds and got myself a tan and came back.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is our vision of the universe has changed enormously. And, you know, I got a shock. I was speaking at the University of Detroit in the afternoon. I often do afternoon talks before my campus lecture. And
mm-hmm.
I was going over how much things have changed technologically and so forth. I said, look, when I started work in industry, I was using a slide rule.
Mm.
And I looked around the class, didn't get anybody batting an eye. So I had the gall to ask, can any of you know what a slide rule is? Not one student in the two classes, about 75 students, knew what a slide rule was, and that was less than 50 years earlier.
Wow.
So what I'm saying is we need to recognize that we don't know all there is to know. I've just been doing one of the chapters on the new book has to do with cold fusion, which is one of those confusing situations. And
that actually works now that we know of.
Well,
it always did to a point.
There are some exciting aspects of it, but I'm going over how in the past other areas there were uncertainties. We didn't know. We thought we had it all, you know, right down pat, and we turned out to be totally wrong. In building materials and other things.
Well, it bugged me. The Department of Energy poo-pooed it for 14 years, and we had 15,000 successful tests of the power of the sun on people's desktops. So think of the time wasted. Although somebody wasn't wasting their time, because the Navy admits they were working on it all along, and now they've improved
it,
you know, over MIT and over UCLA.
The Japanese have spent a lot of money. The Electric Power Research Institute has spent a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question. We don't have a full understanding. But, you know, I've always been interested in far-out materials because I worked on radiation shielding for nuclear airplanes, nuclear rockets, stuff like that.
Cool.
You end up with some weirdos. I mean, lithium hydride, beryllium oxide, boron carbide, tungsten alloys, gadolinium hydride, we even looked at once. All this crazy sort of stuff. And what you find is that material properties are very dependent on trivial details. The Navy was going to use, or tried to use, liquid sodium as a coolant in their reactors because it's a much better heat transfer agent than water.
Mm.
And operates at lower pressure. The problem was the heat transfer loops were being corroded sometimes. And they couldn't figure out how come this loop is corroded and this one isn't. It took a lot of effort to figure out, oh, gee, it's the amount of oxygen in the sodium. Well, the best they could measure when they started was like 100 parts per million. And these two are the same. Then when you get much better, oh, this one's only got 10 parts per million. This one's got 50, and it corrodes, and the first one doesn't. But until you can measure that, you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so palladium is the metal in the cold fusion. Quite expensive material, incidentally, heavier than lead a little bit, and it absorbs more hydrogen than anything else, and that's why people were calling it fusion. Maybe heavy hydrogen was hiding in the interstices of the palladium, and the pressures were so great that the heavy hydrogen nuclei would react and fuse and produce energy, and we still don't fully understand it. But the Navy is certainly interested because anything that offers you the possibility of producing quite a bit more energy out than you put in a small device, hey, let's look at it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you start looking at how some of the academic scientists have looked at some of these things, and that's why the title of the book is Science Was Wrong. Incidentally, I'll mention the other two books because they deal with two very different subjects. They're all listed at the website,
mm-hmm.
www.sandfriedman.com. One is Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C. That's about the Majestic 12 documents. And boy, you want to find baloney. There is more baloney written against the MJ-12 documents. I consider four to be legitimate and well over 100 to be frauds.
Disinformation, obviously.
Yeah, well, it's perfectly natural for government. If good stuff gets out, you flood the market with garbage. And you hope it rubs off on the good stuff. And I keep getting people saying, everybody knows that those documents are all fraudulent, except Stan Friedman. I don't know they're all fraudulent. I know four are legitimate, and the rest are fraudulent. It's the legitimate ones that matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I keep asking for, give me a good argument. I've faced up to all the objections that have been raised. Oh, you'll get a kick out of one of them. Philip Klass, who was
Mr. Poo-Poo?
Mr. what?
Mr. Poo-Poo, as I call him.
Well, yeah, okay. Phil challenged me about the typeface on the memo from Robert Cutler, supposedly, to General Nathan Twining.
I remember that, yeah.
And he pointed out that perhaps I hadn't noticed, but that the memo was done in the large Planka type. But he had a number of samples of documents from the National Security Council in the right time frame, and they were all done in elite type, smaller. So in order to encourage me to respond more quickly, he offered me $100 each for every genuine document. He had a bunch of criteria. Done in the same size and style Tyka type, up to a limit of 10, unfortunately. And to make
Shucks.
A long story short, and it's all in my final report on Operation Majestic 12, and even Flying Saucers and Science, my book from last year, has a copy of his check to me. He sent me, I dug out 14 documents meeting all his criteria, sent him an invoice for $1,000, sent me a check.
Wow.
I included a copy of the check in a report. He got mad at me. And so forth. His father was a lawyer, so he knew how to write.
Why? He said he was going to do it.
Well, he did it. He kept his word. But he was going to sue me for publishing the letter. The check. I'm sorry. So I wrote him back saying, Phil, you sent me a check. I Xeroxed it. I took the check to the bank. They cashed it. I can do whatever I darn please with the Xerox. And then he shut up.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the crazy thing, and it's typical of the intellectual bankruptcy of the pseudoscience of anti-ufology. The Eisenhower Library alone has 250,000 pages of National Security Council materials.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are still classified, incidentally. But to suggest that because you've got nine done in the same typeface, that you can extrapolate from nine to 250,000.
It's ridiculous.
It's absurd, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you got 99 out of 100 and you're missing one, and all the 99 are not the same typeface, well, maybe you say, oh, it doesn't seem like it. There was another typewriter around. But, of course, I should point out, he had never been to the Eisenhower Library. I've spent weeks there. And that's typical of the nasty, noisy negativist. Four basic rules for debunkers. Anybody listening wants to be a debunker. It's easy. You're the four rules. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. Whole bunch of anti-UFO books never mention the largest study of flying saucers ever done for the government, Project Blue Book, Special Report 14. The third is, if you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And number four is, do your research by proclamation. Investigation is just too much trouble and nobody will know the difference anyway. So it's easy, and I see it with Majestic 12 documents. Oh, my fourth book, another area where you'll find a lot of nonsense, Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident. And I keep reading junk. I guess it's from Debunker A repeats what Debunker B said, which was really what Debunker C said, which was a quote from Debunker D, who didn't know what the heck he was talking about and made it up as he went along.
It just propagates itself.
Yeah, you know, it's really crazy how these guys try to get away with this stuff. And well, let me give you an example. I was on Coast to Coast Radio with Michael Sherman, Dr. Michael Sherman. Now, he and I and six other people had been on the Larry King Show in July of 2007. And Michael's contribution to the show was primarily playing with little alien dolls. He won't believe how many email I got, and I don't understand why I didn't just knock him off his chair. I said, not my style. Anyway, George Norrie was on the program, host of Coast to Coast Radio, and so I contacted George after it, and I said, how about a debate between Michael and me? He's been on your show, hasn't he? Yes. Okay, so it's arranged.
Yeah.
2 weeks later. 2 weeks later. And he starts off, Michael, this is for 3 hours, mind you, 3 to 6 in the morning, my
wow.
And he starts off by saying, hey, there's nothing a UFO, just like all this other paranormal junk. There's a residue effect. You don't have enough data, so there's a certain percentage, 5%, that you can't really identify. Wow, did that give me a chance to blast away? That's totally untrue. Blue Book Special Report 14, which I mentioned a few minutes ago. Largest study ever done for the Air Force, 3,201 sightings. They concluded that the unknowns were 21.5% of the 3,201 cases, completely separate from the 9.3%.
That's a lot. Yep, that's a lot.
Yeah, completely separate from the 9.3% that were listed as insufficient information. I pointed out the University of Colorado study, according to a special UFO subcommittee of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, 30% of the 117 cases studied in detail could not be identified. Richard Hall, in his book, The UFO Evidence, it was 18% of 4,500 cases could not be identified. I named a couple more, but it was downhill from there. He hadn't done his homework. I read two of his books and quoted some of the reasons for non-belief back at him. He hadn't read anything. So the final vote was I got 80% of the vote, and he got 20%. Ignorance was bliss, but it doesn't pay off when you're trying to talk to somebody, with somebody who knows what he's talking about.
I love to watch you on Larry King Live when McGagee says
Bill
something.
With Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yeah, and McGagee, the Air Force retired poo-pooer, you know, that says something, and you just cut him up.
James McGaughan, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Incidentally, for those who want an enlightened...
Oh, we're coming down to 20 seconds, by the way, for the next one.
Okay, there is a video, a DVD. Are Flying Saucers Real? It's 2 hours between myself and James McGaughan, retired Air Force.
Wow.
This is at a university, a very formal debate with the moderator and stuff. And I'll tell you how to get it when we come
wow.
back.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break now. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Music, talk, and winning. This is LAFM, the best of the best.
A message from Kentucky State Police.
30% of all highway fatalities in the United States are caused by speeding. I'm Commissioner Rodney Brewer of the Kentucky State Police, reminding you that law enforcement will be cracking down on speeders and aggressive drivers this summer. The minutes you think you save by speeding are not worth the risks. Obey the signs or pay the fines. And most importantly, drive to stay alive.
A public service message brought to you by Kentucky Farm Bureau, Kentucky State Police, and this radio station.
Did you ever want to know your future before it happens? Do you want to connect with loved ones who have crossed over? Are you interested in learning more about yourself, your past lives, and where you are going? Then you cannot miss The Awakening. Every Thursday night, psychic mediums Serena Gordon and James and Kelly Collins challenge you to expand your reality and provide insight into the mysteries of life. The Awakening, Thursday nights, 9 p.m. on AllieFM.com. Expand your reality with The Awakening.
Welcome back to the final part of our show with Stanton Friedman. It's been very interesting, Stanton. Let's hear what else you have to say, and if you can tell us a little bit more about your new book, if you can.
Well, okay. The other book I was talking about was Crash at Corona, the Definitive Study of the Roswell Incident. And there, as with the MJ-12 documents, as with interstellar travel and a number of the other topics around flying saucers, is an awful lot of garbage out there. And people, you know, there's no law against lying. There are libel laws. You can lie, and anybody who looks at the internet knows that there's a lot of junk out there. But Roswell has become a prime target. For example, the scientist who heads the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, well, I say scientist, Dr. Joseph Nickley, he's got 3 degrees. They're all in English. And he's worked as a magician, which is a master of deception. I don't quite know where any kind of scientific investigation. Joe came up with a great identification for the Flatwoods Monster, 1952 case. It was a 6-foot-tall owl.
Yeah,
and everybody knows they're
that.
Flying around all over the place.
Oh, yeah, 6 foot, yeah.
But he also, and there's a good book about Flatwoods, incidentally, Shoot Them Down by Frank Fischino, who spent 18 years working on Flatwoods. He's talked to people nobody else has talked to. And I wrote the foreword for the book. Joe had an explanation for Roswell at the 50th anniversary.
Weren't you over there in West Virginia when he had his first show, and then he had another show recently? Weren't you there at each of those, I think?
Well, yeah, I was there with Frank on the 50th anniversary of Flatwoods, and there was another one just a little while ago, and I was at another one last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll see Frank in West Virginia next week, as a matter of fact. We're doing a television piece about the case. And the thing is that Joe as silly as the sixth balloon, the owl was, when he talked about Roswell 10 years ago, he said, oh, he knew what the answer was. We were on opposite ends of an interview. I was in Roswell at the museum, and he was in Los Angeles. We couldn't see each other, but we could hear each other. And he had a straightforward explanation. It's very simple. The PR guy put out the press release to try to get attention. I said, you don't even know his name, do you? Well, no. I said, well, I've known him for almost 20 years. The notion that the public relations man for the most elite military group in the world, the 509th, I mean, it only dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, tested two more in the Pacific in Operation Crossroads in 1946, that the PR guy for them would put out a press release on his own is absolutely absurd. Well, you know, 10 years later, he had an article in their magazine, Skeptical Inquirer, in which he basically repeated it, saying that an inexperienced public relations man put out an unauthorized press release. Garbage! Colonel Blanchard, the base commander and the head of the 509th, and he and Walter were quite close, had ordered him to put out the press release. You know, that's the first thing. How does a guy get off making claims like that?
Well, he won't talk to me on email. I just blasted him back, and he will not answer my emails anymore.
Joe?
Yeah, he won't talk to me.
Yeah, well, that doesn't surprise me. He follows the four basic rules for debunkers that I laid down before. And he's in another program on George Norrie. He said, you know, the problem with Roswell is people don't look at the original data. After all, the newspaper article says it's just a bundle of sticks and rubber and paper and balsa wood, and somehow that's grown into this enormous crazy story. But he doesn't tell you, oh, that's from the article on July 9th, after the rancher had been brought in to change his story, which we know from neighbors and the rancher's son, et cetera. And the article on July 8th said the stuff covered 200 square, it was found within a radius of 200 meters, I guess.
Wow.
No, feet. And that the explanation makes no sense at all, but don't bother me with the facts. Also, incidentally, the original article said found last week. Now, this wasn't just in Roswell, although you'd think it was from the noisy negative. It was in the Chicago Daily News. It was in the Sacramento Bee. It was in the Los Angeles Herald Express. It was in the San Francisco paper. A whole bunch of papers from Chicago West. And the reason it wasn't in the New York Times is that the story came out too late because of the time zone. The cover-up story was there the next day, of course. But so he comes up with these explanations, which make no sense at all. Basically, they're lies.
You got 50 seconds left.
Okay, well, if you want facts and data, go to my website, www.santonfriedman.com. A lot of articles, all my books are listed. It's a lot of facts, and believe me, there are. The poll results, the lies from the government, the misrepresentations on the part of the nasty, noisy negativists, they're there for everybody to see.
Well, I'll tell you, Stanton, you've got something, so much to talk about, and there's so many questions I'd like to ask you. Sometime I'd like to have you back for a two-hour show because, well, we could fill a four-hour show, I mean, with all the information you have, obviously. But it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope to have you back soon if your schedule permits. Our listeners would love to hear from you. And this has been Conspiracy with Earl Benezet and my special guest, Stanton Friedman. And have a good night, and I hope to help you folks tune in to our next show. Have a good night.
Good night.
You You've been listening to Conspiracy with Earl Benezet and special guest co-host Bill Scott. Make sure to tune in again next week at this same time on Alley FM for Conspiracy with Earl Benezet. Email questions or comments to alleyfmradio@gmail.com. On behalf of Earl Benezet and Bill Scott, I'm Chris Long. Thanks for listening to alleyfm.com, the best of the best.